Muslims will fight them, and they will be hiding themselves behind the trees and the rocks. Even the trees and the rocks, they hate the Jews. And the trees and the rocks would say, Ya Abdullah, O servant of Allah, come, there is a Jew behind me, kill him.
وارضت غدت برجالها مسيوجة
مسيوجة
لهل العدا سم وطريق اللاوي ولهل الهدى واد وساع فجوجة مرقى براسه والشرف متساوي
واسماؤهم
This is Adrian Morgan, Global Security Matters.
It is the 24th of May. I'm Adrian Morgan. I don't even think Reese Cup, my former co-host, is even aware that I'm doing a show tonight. I was asked to carry on filling this slot, and I was going to say, well, no, last week was my official last show. But obviously the incidents from 2 days ago in Woolwich in southeast London are extremely important. They are a new development in terrorism. They should make everybody very much more aware that things can get very nasty from now on, because terrorism is not just about people with bombs or hijacking planes. We've got to remember that in 2004, on November the 2nd, Theo van Gogh, a descendant of the brother of the artist Vincent van Gogh, was murdered in an Amsterdam street. He was shot. He was hacked at with a knife. In fact, his killer, a man called Mohamed Bouyeri from Morocco, was trying to sever his head. It seems to me this awful, ghastly theatre of jihad seems to get worse whenever there are wars going on. And last week I was discussing about how Abu Sukkar, who is one of the leaders of the Syrian jihad, one of the so-called opposition, the rebels, was shown cutting out the heart of a Syrian soldier and then going to eat it. What happened on Wednesday, when a Royal Fusilier, a 25-year-old soldier based at Woolwich Barracks, a man called Lee Rigby, just returned, was going to be demobilized back for a holiday with his family up in the north of England, was crossing a road, and a blue car rammed into him. This was in the early afternoon. Children were about to be released from their primary schools, and once he was hit by the car had driven him off the pavement, onto the main road, onto the sidewalk, as Americans would understand it. And then he was dragged further to the side of the road, out of the car. People jumped out of the car and immediately started hacking at his head with machetes and axes. And then, once they had pretty much mutilated him, dragged him back out into the middle of the road and carried on hacking at him to make a public display. Now, then it took 20 minutes for the police to arrive. People were shocked. And one of the most bizarre, surrealistic scenarios unfolded after that. 20 minutes while these two killers were standing over the body, then going and talking to people, and then people from the public were going and talking to the killers, mostly women. They would only let women go near the body. And then one of them asked a man who was on a bus journey to go to a job interview, asked him, this man turned out to be a man called Michael, get his name, Adebolaja, which is a Yoruba Nigerian name, asked this man to videotape him with his mobile phone camera, which he did. And all around the world, these images of this young black man with hands red with the blood of the soldier he had killed was saying about how you are never going to be safe, and saying that the only way it will stop is when governments remove soldiers from, he didn't even mention Muslim lands, he actually said our Arab lands. He mentioned Afghanistan. Afghanistan, the majority of the population of Afghanistan aren't even Arabs. But it's a trope, it's a cliche. It is something which needs to be dealt with very, which is what I want to discuss on this show. And then while he was talking, a woman dressed in blue, pushing a little pram with a child in it, just walked straight past him, past this killer with a machete and an axe in his hands, and a woman with her child just pushed past him, and nothing was... This was one of the most bizarre, surreal things I think I've ever seen on a video. The fact that the killers didn't intend to run. They were waiting for the police to arrive so that they could then end up being shot at. Now, just hang on one second. I'm just going to answer that. I don't really want to have too many phone calls right at the beginning of the show because I'm trying to lay the ground of what's going on. So I'm just going to quickly answer this. Hang on one sec. Hello, caller. Hello, Okay, it sounds like we got goldfish at the bottom of a fish tank. Is there anybody there who can actually talk coherently on a clear line? Hello?
Hello?
Hello? Hello, caller. No, you've gone. Right, okay. Sorry about it. Right, now, what has really annoyed me about this, so many things have annoyed me about this whole incident. The people who carried out the attack, now we're not too sure, the second character has only been named today, he's a man called Michael Adebowale, but the first character, Michael Adebolaja, was first introduced to radical Islam in 2003, he was introduced to radical Islam by the Al Mujaharoon Network. Oh, we got the same caller trying to call again. Just one sec.
Hello.
Hello. There's a real problem with that person's phone line. If anybody is trying to call in, can you call in about 15 minutes? Let me get the show on the way, please, because it's going to be very difficult if, as soon as you talk, I can't hear a word. If you have Skype, try to call in using Skype. It is probably a lot easier to use Skype to call in. If you're calling from... well, the 910 is the code where you're coming from. I don't know if that's... I expect that's in America. If you're not getting a good reception, then unfortunately, you're just going to ruin the show trying to, you know, get me to talk. I know you're trying to talk. There's a woman on the end of the phone. You're not a troll, apparently. So if you can try to use Skype, please do. Anyway, what happened was with this character... Michael Adebolaja was radicalized in 2003 by Al Mujaharoon. Al Mujaharoon, in that year, had already sent one of its members out to commit a terrorist attack. This terrorist attack took place in Tel Aviv, in Israel. Two characters, one called Asif Hanif, who was from Al-Mujahharun, a very large, overweight character, had gone into a bar called Mike's Place on the seafront at Tel Aviv. He had with him a friend who was, again, connected with Al-Mujahharun, but he was more popularly known as being a Hizb ut-Tahrir member. And he, the man called Omar Sharif, had gone with him into the bar. They had both tried to detonate their suicide belt simultaneously. Asif Hanif blew himself up and killed three people, injured 60 others. Omar Sharif could not do this. And then he had run off. He reappeared several days later, floating, his body decomposing in the waters on the shore just outside Tel Aviv. Now, it appears very strong evidence seems to be tying the fact that these characters were sent by Al-Mujahharun to mix with Hamas, and then once they were with Hamas, they were then instructed in how to get their explosives and how to carry out their bombings. Now, this is in 2003. That should have been enough information for the authorities in Britain to close down Al-Mujahharun, but they did not. Al-Mujahharun has a history, and that is what this show is going to be about. I'm going to give you all of the details that you will need to know about who founded it, when it was founded, what it set itself up for. Now, once again, we have the same caller. Right. Hello, caller.
Adrian, it's Jennifer. I'm just trying to listen to the podcast, and I'm at the radio
center. Sorry. Okay, well, if you're going to listen, I'll put you on hold, okay?
All right, sorry, dear.
All right, bye-bye. Yeah, it doesn't always help when I don't have my wonderful co-host, Reese Cup. That's why she was so wonderful, because she could deal with the callers while I dealt with the show. And I don't want any callers in for a while, because it does distract. I do have a lot of facts I want to get through. I want to deal with the incident yesterday, but there is a lot of stuff that really suggests that this group should have been banned. Now, everybody has heard of Anjem Chowdhury. Anjem Chowdhury was the British second in command of Al-Mujahharun. Now, let's wind the clock back. The very first person to be killed in the name of jihad in Britain, on British soil, was a man, an African student, young guy, Christian, from Nigeria, and Ayatunde Obanubi. He was a student at Newham Technical College, and in February, just after Omar Bakri Mohammed, who at that time was the leader of Hizb ut-Tahrir, with a large contingent of people from this college who would then go on to form the backbone of Al-Mujahharun, because Al-Mujahharun officially did not come into being until February the 18th, 1996. But a year before that, in 1995, February, young man, David, or Ayatunde Obanubi, was apparently said to have insulted these people who were standing on the front of the steps handing out leaflets. He sneered at their leaflets. He was, on a Friday, he was stabbed in the arm while playing table tennis by one of these Islamists from the college. The night before, on the Thursday night, that was when Omar Bakri Mohammed had been talking in the auditorium of this college. The next day, the Friday, they were very fired up. On the Monday, which was February the 27th, when David Ayatunde was at college, he stepped out at lunchtime. he was on the steps of the college, a group of people, Hizbut Tahrir members, who would then become people who would make up the backbone of al-Mujahirun, attacked him. He was stabbed through the heart with a knife. He was clubbed on the head with a hammer. And three people were taken to court. Four people were taken to court. Two were let off. Two were convicted. One was a minor, and he changed his name. The other one was a Hizbut Tahrir leader. Now, one of the people who was let off, he was accused of being one of the people who had killed this young man. He eventually, in 2006, in the winter of 2006, he was convicted of trying to get anti-aircraft shoulder-based missiles, like bazookas, anti-aircraft, handheld anti-aircraft guns, to fire at aeroplanes over Heathrow. Now, he had been let off. He had been one of the crowd who had killed this man. Hizbut Tahrir at that time was the name of the group. And then after this incident with this killing of the student, the global Hizbut Tahrir organization, Hizbut Tahrir was founded in 1953 in Jerusalem by an Islamic jurist. And its aim is to set up a caliphate. Omar Bakri Muhammad, who had been kicked out of Saudi Arabia, had formed the British branch of Hizbut Tahrir in 1986. 3 years earlier, in Saudi Arabia, he had founded a group called al-Mujahirun, which was really a branch of Hizbut Tahrir, but they couldn't. Hizbut Tahrir is banned in most Muslim countries because they don't want a caliphate, because a caliphate would mean dictatorships and governments would disappear. Now, when Omar Bakri Muhammad set up this group called al-Mujahirun in 1983 in Saudi Arabia, he wasn't calling it a Hizbut Tahrir group. The name al-Mujahirun was the name that Muhammad's followers, when they went to Medina, that was the name which means the emigrants, was the name they gave themselves. In 1985, this man, Omar Bakri Muhammad, whose real surname is Fostok, was kicked out of Saudi Arabia, arrived in Britain, and then with a Syrian, he set up in March of 1986, he helped to set up Hizbut Tahrir, the British branch. After the killing of the student in February the 27th, 1995, the global Hizbut Tahrir movement said that they could not have Omar Bakri Muhammad in charge. So he took the most hard line of these radical young students, like those who had been at Newham College, a college which now no longer exists because of the scandal of what happened. These students then, in February 1996, became al-Mujahirun. One of the leading figures then was Anjem Chowdhury. Now, because of Britain's laws, the groups like al-Mujahirun, when as soon as they get banned, they reform under various names. So we have had names for Anjem Chowdhury's groups have been Islam for UK, Al-Sunnah Wal Jama, the Save Sect, the Saviour Sect, Al-Ghuraba, Muslims for Sharia. The most current incarnation has been Muslims Against Crusades. But they are all the same members. They don't number any more than about 1,500 core individuals. That is about all that they are. Britain has a nation of about 60 million people. 1,500 people maximum are ardent members, the core members of this group. But they have been preaching death and jihad and decapitation for a very, very long time. Now, I'm going to have a very, very short break. I hope you don't mind. It's nice to see people have arrived into the chat room. Nice to see you. But I want to deal with the history, because it's no point in just what is happening with idiots like David Cameron saying, oh, Islam's a religion of peace. Well, I'm sorry, it is not a perversion. These people very, very literally take very seriously the idea of what jihad, armed jihad, jihad fi sabilillah, if you call it that, jihad on the path of Allah. They take it very, very seriously. Now, I need to take a very quick break. I did explain in the chat room, it's more to do with my bladder is rebelling against me, I'm afraid. Because last week should have been the last show, I've removed most of my bits of music. This is a bit of Chinese tea music. I'll be back in 5 minutes, and I will get with all the details which you need to know. And I do think, please try and listen. If you have a piece of paper and a pen, hopefully some of these names, try and look them up. I want people to be informed by my shows. I don't want people to be made to feel that they're being inserted into things. But there has been a lot of rubbish spoken by politicians, by Muslim representatives, by people on the left about why what happened on Wednesday happened. And I think we need to understand what are the forces, where are they coming from, what are they about, who are these characters, what have they said in the past. The fact that they have openly called for the beheading, if you remember those posters, behead those who insult Islam. And Jim Chowdhury's group, this group, Al-Mujaharun, is the same group. They have been allowed to openly go into the streets, carry out fights. There is a moment on the internet, there are a lot of people on my show on the front page. You can see a photograph taken in 2007 of Andrew Chowdhury talking, preaching in his sort of grey clerical uniform, trying to pretend to be an authority on Islam. And behind him is a man who is Michael Adebolaja, the character who had his red-handed, blood-covered hands with the machetes, who was photographed, the man who killed Lee Rigby. But in 2006, members of Al-Mujaharun had been taken to court, and the same character, Michael Adebolaja, was involved with punching policemen outside of the court when four people from Al-Mujaharun were taken to trial, and yet he was never prosecuted. He has been followed, he has been tracked by MI5, our Homeland Intelligence Group, for quite some time. Same thing with Michael Adebowale, the other man, the 22-year-old man. Now, the two of them together had killed Lee Rigby, this Royal Fusilier. These people, particularly Adebolaja, has been noticed by our authorities who have done nothing. This is what happened with the Finsbury Park Mosque. For years, people knew terrorism was being plotted from Finsbury Park Mosque, and nothing was done. It is a very, very, very serious thing which is happening. What makes me very angry, and I will talk about it later on PJ Media, some wanker called Richard Fernandez is talking about how British people are spineless because they didn't fight the terrorists. The fact that women were trying to talk down to their faces these people who had just killed a man in front of them, that to me is not spineless. That is bravery of a type that is uncommon and compassionate. They were trying to look after the dead soldier. A lot of good things have come out of this killing. Now, the soldier was wearing a Help for Heroes t-shirt. The Help for Heroes is a charity which helps British soldiers who've been injured. And he was wearing one of those t-shirts at the time. Yesterday, so many people were pledging money to this organization, to this charity, that they crashed. They couldn't cope with all the traffic. They went on again last night. They came back online. Some very positive things have come out of this. The EDL descended. I think it was very unwise. I've seen a bit of film today of Tommy Robinson the day after, and he's actually a lot more sober about it, but he was saying about how angry he was. Now, I think a lot of people are angry. But I'm very angry when people like Caroline Glick, who I had a lot of respect for, who's one of the editors of the Jerusalem Post, praising this article by Richard Fernandez and PJ Media, saying that the British people were spineless, when this soldier hadn't even been named by then, he hasn't even been buried yet. I had to drop a Facebook friend tonight because he had decided to use the image of this soldier who was hit by a car. He wasn't first attacked with machetes. He was injured and lying in the road from the car crash when they had driven this blue vehicle right into, before they ever tried to attack him with machetes. And people were using that to argue against Obama's gun control, saying that, oh, if he had a gun, things would be different. Bollocks. It really annoys me when this is a very, very raw situation. It annoys me when the media is trying to then get all of these Muslims to say, Islam doesn't mean that. That's not fair, and they don't have to do that. The only people who need to be held accountable are the terrorists who carried out this action. But a lot of people are jumping in. The BBC is trying to even question, is it a terrorist attack or not? It is a terrorist attack because it's designed to inspire fear into people, which is what their aim was. Now, I will continue when I have my little break. And exactly, they were in shock. I mean, come on, people are asking ridiculous questions. I am going to have my little break because I need it. Here is some tea music. I'll be back in about 5 minutes. But please hang on. I have a lot of information which I think needs to be heard in context. It's very easy for people to just go, oh, it's because of this, or oh, it's because of that. I have been writing about Al-Mujahideen Harun and its members since 2005. I have a lot of information. I have a lot of things, texts I want to read to you of what they have actually said in the past. And why is it that so many of these people have not been arrested? They have not been jailed, and people who oppose them have been. We have a very, very strange situation. It appears that the MI5 are watching these people, but they're not acting. Two of the members of the 7-7 bombing were connected with another group of Al-Mujahideen members who planned to blow up the Ministry of Sound discotheque. It was a nightclub, music club. And they had a massive cache of ammonium nitrate. These were Al-Mujahideen members who had trained in Pakistan with Al-Mujahideen camps, and they'd gone off and met Al-Qaeda. They have direct links with Al-Qaeda in some parts in Pakistan. There was a jihadi pipeline they had set up. They have been involved in so many of Britain's terrorist activities, and two of the 7-7 bombers in 2004, between January and February, on four separate occasions, Shehzad Tanweer and Mohammed Siddiqui Khan were recorded meeting a man called Omar Khayyam, who had been head of a cell that on April the 30th, 2007, five members of this cell were jailed for life for conspiracy to cause explosions. And that was they were monitored more than a year before the attacks, when 52 innocent people were killed by explosions on three tube trains and one number 30 bus in Tavistock Square. There are a lot of details I want to tell you. I want to have my pee. I'm going to talk to you in a minute. Stay with me, please. I can't even get the music to play. That is really odd. The button is not working on the music. And I can't. Something is happening. Inspect element? What's that? Nope. God. Sorry. I think we might have a... Oh, here it is. Finally. Tea music. Phase it up. I can't be bothered. Right, I'm back, and right. Let me now go back to some of the statements which have been made. Now, in Regent's Park Mosque, very large mosque in Regent's Park in London, built by Saudi Arabian money, run. All of the members of the Saudi of this mosque are members of the Saudi government. It had the full support of our useful idiot prince, Prince Charles. And in the end of 2005, a secretary there won an employment tribunal complaint because her employers had accused her of being a witch, which may seem all very funny over here, but we have to remember that in Saudi Arabia, you can still be decapitated for witchcraft and sorcery crimes. So the management of the Saudi Arabian mosque is backwards. They believe in witches. They believe that if a secretary does not obey, she must be a witch. This is the insanity, and this is the largest, or was the largest, mosque in London. Until the East London Mosque was built, again with that idiot Prince Charles supporting it, and again linked to the Saudi Arabian government. They had a man called Abdurrahman al-Sudais, who arrived in 2004 and gave it his full blessing, who has said that Jews are the worst scum of the earth. He has compared them to apes and pigs, which is relating to something in the Quran. But he has also said that they are the worst of all people and that they need to be destroyed. A raging anti-Semite, Abdurrahman al-Sudais is the imam at the Grand Mosque of Mecca. Very important figure. Lots of Muslims felt very honoured to have this man arriving and preaching. But let's get back to what was said by a leading al-Mujahareen member in Regent's Park Mosque. It was recorded on video. It wasn't shown to the public till 2007. He said in 2004, these are his actual words, "He who joins the British Army or the American Army, he is a mortal kafir, and his only hukum," which means punishment, "is for his head to be removed. Indeed, whoever changes his deen, his Muslim code of life, kill him." That was in 2004, okay? Now, in 2006, a 24-year-old soldier called Lance Corporal Jabron Hashmi was killed in Helmand province in Afghanistan. He was a Muslim who had joined the British Army. There are several Muslims fighting in the British Army, protecting Britain's interests. And Lance Corporal Jabron Hashmi was shot in Helmand province. Now, Anjem Chowdhury, he was killed, in I think it was June of 2006. Anjem Chowdhury put a photograph of Lance Corporal Jabron Hashmi and sort of had the picture surrounded by flames and called this man a homegrown terrorist. In the same year, in Sparkbrook, at a mosque, which is in Birmingham in the centre of Britain, a mosque which is run by the UK Islamic Mission, UKIM, an imam was filmed there talking about Lance Corporal Jabron Hashmi, and the preacher said, "There was an individual who was killed in Afghanistan recently, a Muslim name. He came from a Pakistani family. Do you know what they had written in a tabloid newspaper? Hero of Islam. Hero of Islam who went into Muslim Afghanistan to kill Muslims? Why? Because their crime is implementing Islam. The hero of Islam is the one who separated his head from his shoulders." Now, the attempt was with Lee Rigby to decapitate him. There was virtually nothing left of his head. One of the first blows which he received had split his skull open. But this idea of the punishment should be beheading. Now, Hashmi had not been beheaded. He had been shot. And a statement from Omar Bakri Muhammad, who was the real ideologue. He still preaches. He still has connections. When he left Britain in 2005, he was using PAL Talk to give instructions to his followers. He was in Lebanon, was going to set up a madrasa there. But I'll talk about that later. Omar Bakri Muhammad said, "British Muslims who join the army and kill other Muslims are terrorists. I hope they capture British Muslims who are really in the army there in Iraq and Afghanistan. They are apostates. We will strike your neck." Now, fast forward, January 2007. In Sparkhill, another not Spark Brook. This is right next door to it. Spark Hill, again in Birmingham. Several men were arrested in January 2007. And a man called Parviz Khan, aged 37, who used to go to the Maktaba bookstore, admitted that he'd led a plot to get a British Muslim soldier, keep him tied up in a lock-up garage, use videotapes to show him being tortured, and then finally to behead him and capture the decapitation on video. Now, they were going to kidnap this soldier. They actually had targeted a specific soldier who was Muslim, who was in the British Army. They had his name already sorted out. Now, they were going to get drug dealers to kidnap this soldier from the Broad Street area of the centre of the city, then imprison him, and then they were going to circulate the video on the internet. And this man was a corporal in military intelligence. There were 25 individuals that Parviz Khan, people who were in the army, Parviz Khan had worked out of all these 25 people he had shortlisted, this was the soldier he was going to torture, kidnap, and decapitate and capture the beheading on film. Now, this was back in 2007. He was arrested. There were three other people, a man called Baziru Gassama, who said that he knew of the plot but didn't report it. Another man, Mohammed Irfan, aged 31, and another man called Hamid Al-Azmar, aged 44. They were both, they pleaded guilty of supplying equipment to Parviz Khan. So that was 2007. This idea of beheading soldiers, particularly Muslim soldiers. Now, Lee Rigby, who was killed on Wednesday, was not a Muslim soldier. He was just an ordinary, he was called drummer. He was a drummer, but he was officially in the Royal Fusiliers. Now, this idea of decapitation, let's move the clock a bit further forward, or going backwards again. Let's go to February the 3rd, 2006. At the end of the previous year, Jyllands Posten, a Danish newspaper, had printed 12 cartoons of Muhammad. Because an author there said that he wanted to write a book on Muhammad, well, he had written it, and he wanted to find an illustrator to do pictures. But no artist that he approached would dare do a drawing of Muhammad because they had already been terrorized because Theo van Gogh had already been murdered in an Amsterdam street by Muhammad Bouyeri, who had been trying to cut his head off. He was shot on his bicycle 2nd of November 2004. He had been going on his bicycle. Muhammad Bouyeri from Morocco shot him. He fell off his bicycle. Then he started to stab him, and he tried to cut his throat while Theo van Gogh was pleading for mercy. So when people in Denmark said, well, no, I don't want to do any drawings, Jyllands Posten, they put out a competition. They said, well, if you're an artist, send us your pictures. Lots of people sent in pictures. 12 of them were reproduced, the most famous one being by Vestergaard of Muhammad with his head in a turban becoming a bomb. That was what they really didn't like. The idea of, you don't portray Islam as being violent and we will kill you to prove that we are not violent. It's a sort of an, I don't think they quite worked out the logic of that. But anyway, Muhammad Bouyeri had tried to decapitate his victim, Theo van Gogh, a year before. And so when, again, this had happened with the publication of the Jyllands Posten, Al-Mujahroon in Britain had a demonstration. That was when they were carrying placards saying, behead those who insult Islam. Now, let me just read to you what... Now, this was written by Anjem Chowdhury, and it was written on his website, and it was his statement about What happens to people who insult the prophet? Now, I have to scroll up a little bit because I've got a lot of information here. Okay. Now, it's a very long statement. This was a piece that appeared on the website Al Gharaba, one of the many front groups that Al-Mujahareen members have hidden behind. And it states, it was entitled, Kill Those Who Insult the Prophet Muhammad. Now, it starts off talking about the Danish newspapers. And eventually, Kurt Vestergaard was attacked in his own home by a Somali armed with an axe who was trying to cut off this 74-year-old artist's head. He had his granddaughter in the house. Fortunately, she was asleep and she wasn't aware of what was going on. Police arrived, shot the Somali attacker in his hand. But that happened later. In February the 3rd, 2006, this was what was published. On the same time as they had a massive demonstration, when they had placards saying, behead those who insult Islam. Europe, you will pay. Islam is on its way. Okay. And now, it starts, I won't read the first three chapters. Okay. It says, the kuffar will never have respect for our deen. They will never honor it and will always seek to ridicule and disparage it. At every opportunity, they will try to attack and belittle it, you know, our deen, you know, their sort of their faith, whilst concealing the greater hatred they have for it in their hearts. This is also evident throughout the history of Islam, where the kuffar, the unbelievers, carried out similar acts to try and defame Islam. Allah tells us that. Now, this, listen to this bit. This is the most important bit. You'll find this perhaps of interest. At the time of the messenger Muhammad, there were individuals like these who dishonored and insulted him upon whom the Islamic judgment was executed. Such people were not tolerated in the past, and throughout the history of Islam were dealt with according to the Sharia. Ka'b ibn Ashraf was assassinated by Muhammad ibn Maslama for harming the messenger Muhammad by his words. Abu Rafi was killed by Abu Atiq, as the messenger ordered, in the most evil of ways, for swearing at the prophet. Khalid bin Sufyan was killed by Abdullah bin Anis, who cut off his head and brought it to the prophet for harming the messenger Muhammad by his insults. Now, this is a woman. Al-Azma bint Marwan. She was killed by Umayyah bin Adi al-Katmi, a blind man, for writing poetry against the prophet and insulting him in it. Al-Aswad al-Ansi was killed by Firuz al-Daylami and his family for insulting the messenger Muhammad and claiming to be a prophet himself. Shortly after these incidents, this is what Chowdhury was writing, the people began to realize that insulting the messenger of Allah was not something to be taken lightly, and that by doing so would mean that you would be killed for it, a concept that many have seemed to have forgotten. This guy is openly threatening killing. Now, what happens as a result? Now, this, what was really, and it carries on, you know, it isn't just the insulting of the messenger Muhammad is something that the Muslims cannot and will not tolerate, and the punishment in Islam for the one who does so is death. This is the sunnah of the prophet and the verdict of Islam upon such people, one that any Muslim is able to execute. I mean, this is like saying, exactly, people have mentioned Inspire, the magazine by Al-Qaeda, the online magazine. Now, this is something that they have been saying, you are entitled. Now, I was saying that back with Al-Mujahareen, led by Omar Bakri Muhammad, who was born in Syria, who had lived in Saudi Arabia, kicked out of Saudi Arabia, for forming a group called Al-Mujahareen originally, which was a branch of Hizb ut-Tahrir, 1985, he was kicked out, arrived in Britain. 1986, he set up the British branch of Hizbut Tahrir. February 1995, Newham College, David Ayatunde Obanubi, an African student, a Christian, was murdered by his followers a few days after he had preached at the college, and he was kicked out of Hizbut Tahrir. He took the most hardline members of this group, and in 1996 they formed Al-Mujahharoon. Leading figure was Anjem Chowdhury, a lawyer. Anjem Chowdhury used to be a student. He came from Kettering. His father had a stall, a market stall, and he was a fairly humble man. Now, Anjem Chowdhury went to two universities. He didn't like one, went to another. He was a student of law. He was, during his college days, was known, he called himself Andy. He used to smoke cannabis. He used to drink alcohol. And he used to buy pornographic magazines to masturbate with. And all things changed later when he had become a member of Omar Bakri Muhammad's team. Now, the things that he was doing now, he would willingly see people killed for. Okay, this character, Anjem Chowdhury, had organized the demonstration where people had the placards saying behead those who insult Islam. He was given a £500 fine for doing this illegal demonstration. That was all of the punishment he got. For 2 weeks, nothing happened. It was only because the members of parliament had protested that anyone was arrested. People were openly calling for the deaths of other people, for the deaths of Danish politicians, for the deaths of Danish cartoonists. And there was even a bit of film. There was a taxi driver on February the 3rd, 2006. This was a demonstration, began in Green Park, ended up outside the Danish embassy in Sloane Square. And the BBC had filmed a taxi driver complaining to a young policeman and saying, "You can't let them do this. You can't let them say all that," you know, threatening to kill people. And the policeman said, "They have a right to have their demonstration. It's their freedom of speech." And he threatened the taxi driver that if he didn't get back in his car and drive off, he would arrest him. That was the police approach. It is bizarre. It is the world turned on its head. It goes back to 1989 when numerous Muslims, for example, Iqbal Sukrani, who would later become knighted by Tony Blair in June 2005, a month before two people connected to Al-Mujahharoon had blown up 52 people on London Transport. Iqbal Sukrani was knighted by Tony Blair in June 2005. In 1989, he was saying that death was too good for Salman Rushdie. Cat Stevens, former singer, became known as Yusuf Islam, had said for Salman Rushdie, "You can be killed." He was saying that he should be killed in a Muslim society. The head of the Bradford Council of Mosques was saying that not only would he try to kill Salman Rushdie himself, he would encourage his children to do it. A man called Kalim Siddiqui, who had actually been out in Tehran when Ayatollah Khomeini had made his death fatwa, he was urging people to kill Salman Rushdie, and not a single person was prosecuted. If I was going around calling for the deaths of people, I would be arrested on the spot. This is something that has been going on for a very long time, which is why this is so important to people who are British in particular. The other aspect of what happened on Wednesday, why this is important to understand what is going on, what is the politics, what is the history, what is the theology behind it. What is important to understand is that now anybody can become a terrorist. This was the message that Inspire magazine was putting out. Their very first edition showed people how you can make a bomb in your mom's kitchen from household items, bleaches and things. I'm not going to go into the details. But it was saying that anybody can do their own jihad. And now, and Jim Chowdhury, even though he was associated with this character, the man who was shown with the bloody hands, Michael Adebolaje, he's saying it's nothing to do with him. I mean, this is the most bizarre attitude. Omar Bakri Mohammed, who had set up Al-Mujahroon, was now praising these people as doing a very brave thing. And this is something that we have allowed in Britain to be promoted. This is the end product. Anybody doesn't even... You don't need to have a bomb. You just need to have a plan. You just need to find your target and follow them, because that's what apparently they had been doing with this soldier, Lee Rigby. They had been following him and then ran their car into him when he was disabled on the ground, attacked him with machetes. Now, this is something that nobody was quite aware of what was going on. I'm really furious at this dumb-corked dickhead, Richard Fernandez, in PJ Media, of the manhood of the West. I mean, you know, he's slagging off the bystanders, but I'm sorry, what else would they do? Nobody ran. I mean, if I saw a madman who had just killed somebody and was still had an axe in his hand, I would run. You know, I would admit it, though. I wouldn't be like Richard Fernandez, safe in his little New York apartment, then talking about how the British people, as he said, are spineless. What a cunt. I'm sorry. He's a cunt. You do not talk about people when that soldier has not even been buried yet. His family are absolutely devastated by this. A lot of people are very, very angry. And then Caroline Glick goes and says, you know, oh, what a great article. No, it's not a great article. There is some really awful crap being thrown around. And I'm trying not to swear, but I've done it already. No, I don't. It's my last show, so fuck it. I mean, my last show was last week. I will change it to adults. But, you know, no, this is something, it's very easy for people who aren't connected or don't know the backgrounds to just sneer. There were a lot of good things about the unity of the people of the region. We do have quite an inclusive, mixed society. That was shown in the Olympics, people pulling together. It really irritates me when people just project onto Britain what they think Britain should be or what they think Britain might be or is from some sneering perspective. And that was what Richard Fernandez in PJ Media, he disgusts me. I had to drop one friend on Facebook for similar, exploiting this tragedy to promote his own politics. It is not right. Okay, now, this thing of decapitation. Death fatwas on soldiers, they have been going on for a very long time. But this idea of killing, it is really something that originally it was all about you kill people who are Muslims who become soldiers. They couldn't get hold of any. These two people were quite amateur, it seems. But it is the future of jihad. People keep on talking about lone wolves. The small group, the only 1,500 members of Jem Chowdhury's mob, have been responsible for radicalizing so many people. A few years back, the Center for Social Cohesion published a report which said that 1 in 7 of Britain's terrorist convictions had involved people from Al-Mujahroon, this group that, you know, Alan Jim Chowdhury is connected to. It may change its name, but it means the same. This year, Richard Dart and his friends, they had planned to go to Wootton Bassett to go and kill, because at Wootton Bassett, that was where soldiers were being repatriated. They're being brought back on a plane, the bodies of dead soldiers, from Iraq or from Afghanistan. They would arrive at Wootton Bassett by air, and then the bodies would be taken through the town. And from the beginning of the Afghan war, the local townspeople had decided to honour these people, that every time there was a repatriation, they would line the streets. And they had done that for every single soldier who had gone through that town. And because of that, they were honoured by the Queen. It is now no longer called Wootton Bassett. It is now called Royal Wootton Bassett. But Anjem Chowdhury's mob, they wanted to demonstrate there a few years back. They were saying that we must go down there to protest. Now, they were doing that in 2007, I believe, or it was 2008, where they were saying they wanted to disrupt these meetings. They thought the people in this town are going to do nothing. This year, there were convictions of people who wanted to go to Royal Wootton Bassett, not just to disrupt the repatriations of the soldiers, but to actually carry out acts of terrorism against the citizens because they supported the soldiers. Now, you may have heard of an idiot called Glenn Greenwald. Now, Glenn Greenwald is a self-hating shill for Hamas, basically. And I'm sure he could sue me for libel, but I don't give a flying crap at the moment. But it is interesting what was said by these soldiers, by these killers of the Soldier League Rigby on Wednesday, when Michael Adebajola was talking to the camera and saying that this, you will never be safe until all your governments pull out your people from our lands, you know, our Arab lands, I think he said. Now, unfortunately, this is a trope that has been used. In 2006, in August, six newspapers had an advertisement which was published in six different newspapers, signed by 150 different Muslim clerics, saying that terrorism would decrease if Britain's foreign policy changed, i.e. if Britain removed its soldiers from Iraq and Afghanistan. At the moment, everybody's planning to remove the soldiers anyway. So it's a bit late in the day, but still, Glenn Greenwald has now, just a few weeks back, this was on, I'm trying to find the date of this article, 24th of April, a month ago today, he wrote in the Guardian newspaper, because this was something that Dzhokhar Tsarnaev was talking about. Dzhokhar Tsarnaev was saying that the American wars in Iraq and Afghanistan had motivated him and his brother to carry out the attack in Boston. Now, then, Umar Farouk Abdulmutallab, the underwear bomber, he had said, I had an agreement with at least one person to attack the United States in retaliation for U.S. support of Israel and in retaliation of the killing of innocent and civilian Muslim populations in Palestine, especially in the blockade of Gaza, the killing of innocent and civilian Muslim populations in Yemen, Iraq, Somalia, Afghanistan, and beyond. Ugh. I hope you noticed. Now, I don't approve of blanket bombings using drones. I think you need to be, if you're going to use a drone, you must use them very sparingly, people who you know are going to be targets. But Obama was making his announcement the other day about cutting back on drones. Is it economics? Is it appeasement? I have a horrible feeling that there is something going on afoot where people are starting to believe these tropes. So Glenn Greenwald then goes on to Faisal Shahzad, the Times Square potential bomber. If the his actual words were, if the United States does not get out of Iraq, Afghanistan and other countries controlled by Muslims, we will be attacking the U.S., saying that Americans only care about their people, but they don't care about the people elsewhere in the world when they die. Okay, now, a man, Najibullah Zazi, who was an Afghan-American, he had been involved in a plot to blow up a subway train in New York City. He had said in his court case, when he pleaded guilty, he said, Your Honor, During the spring and summer of 2008, I conspired with others to travel to Afghanistan to join the Taliban and fight against the U.S. military and its allies. During the training, Al-Qaeda leaders asked us to return to the United States and conduct martyrdom operation. We agreed to this plan. I did so because of my feelings about the, what the United States was doing in Afghanistan. And there is Nidal Hassan used the same excuse. This doesn't mean to say you've got to change your policy because one or two live wire freaks are saying that, you know, we demand it. But this is basically what so many people like Glenn Greenwald, almost like some members of the administration, people in the BBC, seem to be arguing that if we acquiesce to the demands of the terrorists, then there won't be terrorism. That's what terrorism is all about. It's about frightening people so they then go and run scared. With terrorism, you've got to fight it by being strong, by staying true to your principles, and standing up to be counted. You don't fight terrorism by appeasing terrorists, because then they will take more. They will terrorize every aspect of your society. I don't necessarily think it was a good idea to invade Iraq. I think anybody with sanity would see that perhaps maybe Saddam Hussein was a monster, but he at least kept a sort of stability in the country. But those decisions are there. Soldiers are committed to do that. Soldiers do what they are asked to do for their country. And now when soldiers on the street are being killed in Britain, or a soldier, who next? And this climate of terror should be opposed by moral fortitude, not by becoming cowardly and weaselly, or using it for propaganda. This is a really serious incident, and people should take it very, very seriously. Oh, God, people talking about waterboarding. Yeah, okay. In some cases, perhaps. But overall, I mean, one needs to not just say, all right, let's break all the constitutional laws. If you have a constitution, you've got to live by it. So many people say, oh, kick all the Muslims out. You can't do that if people are born in the country. That is a problem. You know, you can't deny one group of people their rights. It is a very difficult area that people are talking about. And jingoistic, oh, go in there and shoot them all up. This is what I'm hearing a lot of. And I want to try and basically put the British point of view of what is happening in Britain. I'm not aligned to the EDL. I'm not aligned to the government. I am just an individual, but I'm an individual who has been studying and researching and writing and blogging on this issue since 2005. I have been vilified, I have been labelled all sorts of ways, but I know what I'm talking about. I am not one to think that there are any easy solutions. The only thing that I can say in the face of terrorism is that people should stick to their beliefs. If you believe in your constitution, you shouldn't erode it. Unfortunately, because of the fears of terrorism, constitutional rights have been removed, and they will carry on being removed. I bought a couple of books recently to try and look at the other side. There's a philosopher called A.C. Grayling, a philosophy tutor, writing a book about how so many liberties which people used to take for granted have been removed by government in the pursuit of dealing with terrorism. But it goes beyond that. When people are censoring themselves because of fear, and our artists, our writers, we have an artist called Grayson Perry. He admitted a few years back, the only one brave enough to do so, to say that he wouldn't dare take on Islam as a subject because he was scared of getting killed. He was the only one morally honest enough to say so. We have censorship of ourselves. All right. Okay, Echo, you can fuck off. I'm just deleting you now. You really are a little shit. Okay, kick. Yes, I do want to kick you. You are gone. I will not tolerate people laughing and joking about this subject. That's another reason why I have been removing myself from this blog. Now, there's, you know, this idea of blogging on the radio, some of the gung-ho idiots who come on, oh, shoot him up, ha-ha. I mean, I despair sometimes. I really, really do despair. Some of the people from the American so-called right are really, I mean, I don't know who they're fighting against. They're fighting against anybody who isn't them, which is why you can't apparently get yourselves re-elected. Okay, let me calm back a bit. There have been riots in Stockholm, etc. I don't want to deal with those. I really want to stick with this thing of what is going on with al-Mujahideen, what they are about, what their philosophy is about. Now, in February 1998, now I'm going back a long time, you know, it's a long time, you may think, it's, how many years is it? I mean, that's 15 years ago. Omar Bakri Muhammad, the founder of al-Mujahideen, he had founded al-Mujahideen only 2 years before. Sorry. He said of a fatwa that he issued, he said, the fatwa is jihad against the US and British government, against their armies, interests, airports, and instructions. And it has been given because of the US and British aggression against Muslims and the Muslim land of Iraq. We confirm that the only Islamic fatwa against this explicit aggression is jihad. Therefore, the message for the British governments or any other government of non-Muslim countries is to stay away from Iraq, Palestine, Pakistan, Arabia, etc., or face full-scale war of jihad, which it is the responsibility and the duty of every Muslim around the world to participate in. We call upon Muslims around the world, including Muslims in the USA and in Britain, to confront by all means, whether verbally, financially, politically, or militarily, the US and British aggression, and to do their Islamic duty in relieving the Iraqi people from unjust sanctions. And he was saying that bombings of the United States embassies in Africa, which happened in 1998 in that year, he said they were legitimate targets. He's the same character who, after 2001 and 9/11, he put up posters saying the Magnificent 19, referring to the 19 people who had boarded the various planes and hijacked them with the intention of flying them into targets and killing them on board. The Magnificent 19. This is the ideological leader of al-Mujahideen. And Jim Chowdhury is next down in line. And there is another man, part of this hierarchy, called Abu Izzedin, who is even more vocal. He is originally a black man. He was an electrician called Trevor Brooks. He changed his name to Omar Brooks. And then he called himself Abu Izzedin, the father of the sword. And this character, I would like to read you some of the things which he had said straight after the bombings of 7/7 to get an idea of what these people in al-Mujahideen really believe and why it is so important to take note, because they, al-Mujahideen, have already set up a group called Sharia for America. They're tied up with the Islamic Thinkers Society. They even had a bolt hole they had in Queens. They had their own mosque. It's after 2002, it had basically, they'd lost control of it. But they had members in America. They had a little setup in Pakistan. They were sending jihadists from 2001 from Britain. They had help of an American called Muhammad Junaid Baba. His mother had been in the Twin Towers attack. She'd escaped. 2 weeks after 9/11, he had fled. He had gone to Lahore in Pakistan. And there he had set up the Al-Mujahareen office. There was a man called Beg. Can't remember his first name now. I mean, now he, Moazin Beg, who had been kicked out of university when Al-Mujahareen was founded in 1996. They were putting up posters talking about how Jews were pigs and beating up homosexuals, forcing girls to wear headscarves. If they didn't wear headscarves, they would threaten them with violence. They got no chivalry. I mean, women could be punched around. After all, it's in Surah 424. And Al-Mujahareen's violence and refusal to conform has never been challenged. The fact that they could even issue in 1998 a fatwa against Britain's Prime Minister, John Major, at that time, and nothing happened. Omar Bakri Mohammed, the leader, was arrested 16 times and never once convicted of anything. He's not allowed back in the country now. But for some reason, Britain has allowed these people to flourish. Now, Abu Izzeddin, who is a very tall, very imposing figure, he had been interviewed. And let me just bring. There are various individual sayings, but when the Abu Izzeddin in 2001, he was a young man then. He said, "Because I believe America is one of the places where we should be bombing those the government." There are some Muslims that go to America because obviously, you know, like firearms is available inside America to be trained legally. So why not take that opportunity to use the heart of the enemy that's attacking us? And he refuses to denounce the killings of the people on 7/7. He said, "I would never denounce Muslims." And when the interviewer said this in later, in 2005, he said, the interviewer said, "This was murder." And he replied, "No, Mujahideen activity." And then the interviewer said, "Well, it's murder. Innocent people have died." Abu Izzeddin said, "I'm sorry, when you bomb Muslims in Afghanistan, and I saw houses, I saw women and children murdered on a huge scale. Not 50, there was carpet bombing in Afghanistan. Nobody called for the denunciation for the murder of Muslims." Now, this guy had never been to Afghanistan. He's just talking of videos, which is what the jihadists use. They use fear videos. It started off with Abu Musab al-Zarqawi. Well, it really started off with Daniel Pearl when he was decapitated and the video was sent around the world. But Abu Musab al-Zarqawi was decapitating people and having it videotaped while they were chanting Allahu Akbar, cutting their heads off slowly with a blunt knife, it seemed. Various people, Ken Bigley from Liverpool, had that done to him. And others, and really, if you've seen any of those videos, they are appalling things to watch. And people have then been disseminating those around the internet. And Abu Izzeddin and other people in Al-Mujahareen used to get themselves fired up by showing videos of atrocities. You see them on the internet. Often, some of these videos are not even accurate. They were showing, for example, one website, I believe it's still online, they have shown pictures of children born in Iraq. Because of the chemicals, these children are born with deformities, according to these websites. And one of these deformities they show is actually harlequin ichthyosis, which is not caused by genetic damage. It is only happens when people with a recessive gene, two people with the same recessive gene get married and have a child. It's incredibly rare, and it is inherited from the parents. It has nothing to do with chemical warfare or anything like that. But there is so much propaganda. And what we witnessed on Wednesday was part of a propaganda war. These two characters, well, particularly this character, the elder one, the 28-year-old, Michael Adebolajo, not the other one, 22-year-old Michael Adebowale. We've only had his name today. Michael Adebolajo, aged 28, with the red hands, they were hanging around wanting to be filmed. They wanted to be shot to become martyrs. They wanted those shooting videos of them being shot by the police to be put on online. And I'm sure in time we will see some awful videos. When Mohamed Merah in France, in Toulouse, when he went to the Jewish school, he had a portable video camera with him. And he filmed the action of taking up this little blonde girl, pulling her up by her hair in this Jewish school and shooting her through the head, chasing her, picking her up by her hair like she was a doll and shooting her at close range in her head. He'd filmed all of this, all of his killings. And even though he died in a shootout with the French police, and he'd also killed, he had killed French soldiers. Another thing, you know, similar to what had happened. Mohamed Merah had killed three soldiers. There are patterns going on. What this means is that we do need to protect our liberties and the liberties of Muslims who do not subscribe to this particular vengeance ideology. But the ones who do crow about vengeance and injustice that needs to be resolved, they should be very seriously monitored, and not just monitored occasionally, as happened with Michael Adebolajo. He was in 2006 punching police officers and was not prosecuted. He was at the trial of people who had been on, they had been put on trial for the crime of calling for people to have their heads cut off. And he was one of their supporters, attacked the police. And yet now, he has killed somebody, tried to cut his head off. Well, he's basically destroyed his head. There was virtually nothing left of the man's head. This is the horror that is going to be the next chapter. It has become because security measures have made it more difficult to buy materials like the components for bombs, detonators, etc. It's a big palaver. When the 7-7 bombers were producing their bombs, and I said two of those were connected to Omar Khayyam, the leader of another al-Mujahareen cell, Mohammed Siddiqui Khan and Shehzad Tanweer were the two main leaders, tied up through these people from Crawley with the al-Mujahareen network. They were making their material. They made triacetone triperoxide, was the actual bombing material that they used, TATP. And when they were making this in a bath, their hair was being bleached because of, you know, the chemicals used. A tree outside of the window of their apartment was scorched and died because of all the fumes from these chemicals. You know, they had hired an apartment. They weren't living in there. They were just going in there to mix up the chemicals in a bath. They made this crystalline, waxy substance, which then they put in glass jars with nails, put in their backpacks with detonators. It's quite a complicated procedure, getting bombs which work. 2 weeks after 7-7, on the 21st of July 2005, you had four other individuals tried to do another bombing. Now, these characters were tied up with a man who had a bookshop near where I used to live, a Muslim bookshop. But these four characters, the person who had mixed their explosives hadn't got them, he hadn't got the quantities right. And so fortunately, when they were on their tube trains, they had one character on a bus, just like what had happened 2 weeks before. Now, when Hasib Hossein on the 7th of July had been on a bus, for some reason he could not gone, he was intended to go onto a tube train, but the trains, he had gone up, I think, to get batteries. He was seen in a chemist's shop, and then he had got on a bus because he couldn't get back onto the tube subway network because they'd all been closed off because the other bombers had blown up their bombs. The whole underground was shut down. He'd gone on a number 30 bus at Tavistock Square, had blown himself up, and actually killed more people. Now, 2 weeks later, people had tried to copy that. And you had three bombs in backpacks on a bus, on tube trains, and you had the leader of the group had his backpack on a bus. Now, he was in Shoreditch. He had blown himself up, tried to. All that had happened was that he had broken the window of the bus. The three other individuals, when they had detonated their backpacks, this fizzing material had flopped out. There was steam and smoke, and this bubbling material had poured out onto the tube train floor. Then they'd fled. Which is why, what is happening now, anybody can pick up an axe. It means distrust. You will look at people. And I think it will now mean that anybody who, I mean, these didn't even dress. They weren't dressed with how they normally dress on demonstrations. If you look at the photographs on my show page, the little white hat and the Muslim robes that Michael Adebolajo was wearing were not the clothes he was wearing when he attacked. He was wearing normal Western clothes. He would have blended in like other people. So it's going to create distrust. Now, I'm going to carry on. There is more I want to talk about. There are a lot more things about what Al-Mujahroon is about, what they have done, what they want to get up to. And it's time for me to have a short break again. This is Morning from the Peer Gynt Suite by Grieg. Enjoy. Okay, it helps to have my headset on so I can actually talk. Okay. Right. We've only got 25 more minutes left of the show. I want to say to one people in America, I do hope you have a very good Memorial Day weekend. Right. Now, if anybody wants to call in, please do, because now it's the last 25 minutes of the live show. We've lost a couple of our people who normally stay. I don't know what happened to Jeff, but still. The number is... American number is 347-857-1380 if you want to call in. Okay, now, this notion of people using the so-called Muslim lands thing. Now, this, where does this come from? It comes really from the mentor to Osama bin Laden, a man called Abdullah Azzam. In 1979, there was an attempted coup, I've mentioned this several times before, in Saudi Arabia. A group of fanatical fundamentalists who believed that one of their number was a messiah, the Mahdi, the coming future prophet, they had broken into the precinct around the Kaaba, the cubic... the cube where there is the holy stone that is kissed. Now, this failed. They'd killed lots of people, and then they were all, 150 of them were all executed. After that, there was a crackdown. The Saudi government had apparently been trying a brief experiment in liberalism. And because the Russians had invaded Afghanistan at the beginning of 1979, the most appropriate place for the radical fundamentalists who felt they were going to be purged by the Saudi government to run to was Afghanistan. So they went to Afghanistan, and one of the people there who fled with all these radical fundamentalists from Saudi Arabia was a man originally from Pakistan called Abdullah Azzam. Now, Abdullah Azzam had been teaching in Medina University. He was an Islamic scholar, but he was, you know, even more radical than the Saudis, and he's saying something. And once he had got to, he had got himself into Afghanistan with the other migrants, they became what was called at that time the Mujahideen. And you may have seen there's a ridiculous James Bond film from about that period. I think it's got Timothy Dalton playing James Bond. And they are in Afghanistan and they ride off on horseback, protected by the good guys, the Mujahideen. This was all a little bit warped, the idea that if you're fighting against, you know, the enemy of my enemy is my friend, does not always work. And America did briefly fund these people in Afghanistan. But this scholar, Abdullah Azzam, originally from Pakistan, who'd been a lecturer at the Al-Madinah University in Saudi Arabia, which is already pretty hardline, wrote two books. And these books were called, one was translated and was called In Defense of Muslim Lands, and the other one was called Join the Caravan. In both of these, he extended the duties. He wrote down very clearly. Now, I do have these copies on my hard drive. I might be able to find those if I can just quickly hide a few things so I can get to my file. And Azzam, right. Now, this... these two books were saying that it was no longer just the duty of a Muslim to protect the country that he was in if it was under threat. It was saying he extended the parameters to say that everybody would have to, they would have to join the jihad. And this really, it was a, these books, ah, right, I've got one of them here. Join the Caravan. And there was another book which took these later, further on. The Anwar al-Awlaki wrote a book called Constance on the Path of Jihad, which took all of what Abdullah Azam had said. Now, these are all translations, so I've got to skip past the beginnings. Right, part one, reasons for jihad. Now, we are calling upon the Muslims and urging them to proceed to fight for many reasons, at the head of which are the following. And he lists them. Number one, in order that the disbelievers do not dominate. Two, due to the scarcity of men. I don't know what that means. Three, fear of hellfire. Four, fulfilling the duty of jihad and responding to the call of the Lord. Number five, following in the footsteps of the pious predecessors. Number six, establishing a solid foundation as a base for Islam. Number seven, protecting those who are oppressed in the land. Number eight, hoping for martyrdom. Number nine, a shield for the Ummah, which is the nation of Islam globally, and a means for lifting disgrace off them. Number 10, protecting the dignity of the Ummah and repelling the conspiracy of its enemies. Number 11, preservation of the earth and protection from corruption. This is spiritual preservation. Number 12, security of Islamic places of worship. Number 13, protection of the Ummah from punishment, disfigurement, and displacement. It goes on. Number 14, prosperity of the Ummah and surplus of its resources. And number 15, jihad is the highest peak of Islam. Now, he went further, and this Join the Caravan was the first of them, I believe, and then he went a lot further in his second book. And these two books have been number 16, jihad is the most excellent form of worship, and by means of it, the Muslim can reach the highest ranks. In defense of Muslim lands, in that book, he was writing about how everybody has a duty to go on an aggressive jihad. Jihad fi sabilillah, jihad on the path of Allah. Anwar al-Awlaki, born in New Mexico, who used to be the imam at the Dar al-Hijra Mosque, he also took this ideology further in his Constance on the Path of Jihad, and he became involved with Al-Qaeda. Now, what is the problem is so many people saying this is not Islam. This is the new Islam. The new Islam that was forged by Al-Qaeda, and Abdullah Azam is very important within it because he had experience as an Islamic jurist. I mean, in the Muslim Brotherhood, jihad is our way, is the slogan of the Muslim Brotherhood. So let's not be confused by all of these people who have taken Islam and are peaceful, and who say to them Islam is peaceful. There are numerous texts and sources that people quote from, which are from Islam, which do justify Islam. I'm just getting a Facebook message, sorry. And we are hearing now, after what happened on Wednesday in Britain and elsewhere, a lot of people are saying, Islam isn't about this. Since the migration of the people from Saudi Arabia, the jihadists, they went to Afghanistan, they became the core nucleus of Al-Qaeda. And people went from all over. There was a man in Indonesia, Umar Jafar Talib, had gone to fight with them in Afghanistan. He went back to Indonesia and he helped set up a war against Christians, what was called the Moluccan War, in which about 9,000 people were killed. He would go, there were six islands at least where he had conquered the Christians on those islands and forced even the women, elder women and baby girls, to be circumcised, i.e. female genital mutilation, carried out with unhygienic equipment. People put without any anesthetic, having their clitorises and labia cut off. This is what this new aggressive jihad is, something that really needs to be taken very, very seriously. It's not helping anybody for people to try and say, oh, Islam isn't violent. Islam was very violent at its inception. Prophet Muhammad was involved in violence. The first caliph, Abu Bakr, for most of the 17 months that he was a caliph, for 13 months of these, I'm going to have to switch off my Facebook account because I'm getting all these bleeps. When he had his first period in power as the very first caliph after Muhammad died in 632 AD, when Abu Bakr became the caliph, there were numerous people who had decided that there was no point in carrying on being Muslims. They had only become Muslims to keep Muhammad happy, probably to stop him from invading them. And so Abu Bakr had to fight what was called the apostasy wars, or the Ridda wars, which meant that he had to go and fight all of these tribespeople in the Arab region of the Middle East, who had decided they didn't want to be part of Islam anymore. So all of this notion of Islam is not violent, it has had very, very violent roots. There are numerous passages in the Quran which do support violence. Most Muslims don't look at those, fortunately. But it is dishonest to say that there is Islam is not violent. For you as an individual, if you follow Islam and you make it peaceful for yourself, that's great. That's what it should be. But there is a minority of people who are now following this new jihadist version of Islam, which has its own theology. It has its antecedents. It is tied up with the Deobandi and the Wahhabi, who are from Saudi Arabia and from Afghanistan and Pakistan. The Deobandis, I was mentioning before, Syed Ahmed Rai Bareilly, had been influenced by the Arabian Jihad, which had been started in 1740 by Wahhab, the founder of Saudi Wahhabism. He set up his branch of Islam by killing people, Muslims, who he thought were heretics. And unfortunately, Saudi money is now spreading throughout the world. Saudis seem to not see any problems with hypocrisy. In their land, they will kill people for witchcraft and sorcery. There was a horrific photograph on Twitter I was seeing this week of five Yemenis who were part of a gang who were in Saudi Arabia. They were not only decapitated, their heads were put in little bags. And then the bodies were then suspended by their middles and hung up from two cranes. I mean, bizarre, treating human beings like puppets for display. But the Saudi regime believes in Wahhabism, and Wahhabism was founded in a jihad, a violent jihad against other Muslims. Deobandism was founded on the principles set up by people who had witnessed what went on in Saudi Arabia, or it was Arabia then, who'd gone back to India and then started killing Sikhs. We cannot escape the fact that these two movements, Deobandism, which leads to the Taliban were all Deobandi, and Saudi Arabia, are behind a lot of the people who claim to be moderate, and yet they support violence. So I will have to concede that Tommy Robinson said something in a video today, I saw part of it, that the Ahmadis are a really decent group The Ahmadis had their own prophet, a man called Ghulam Ahmed, who revised bits of Islam. They have a slogan that says, do not harm anyone. That is what they live by. They aren't allowed to go to Mecca because they're heretics. You know, it's a question of there are decent, moderate Muslims. But unfortunately, those who are influencing a lot of the mosques are either Saudi Wahhabists, who then put up the money for mosques, and then if they don't have their own preachers or their own approved preachers who are intolerant, they have Deobandi preachers. Birmingham Central Mosque is a prime example. Riyad al-Haq used to be the imam there. He was a man who was arguing for jihad, and he hadn't become radicalized somewhere else. He was radicalized in Bury St. Edmunds in Britain in a madrasa of Deobandi ideology, saying that people should never hang around with Christians or Jews, the same ideology as the Taliban. And we are fighting. Coalition troops are fighting the Taliban. But at home, the mosques are run by people who have the same ideology as the Taliban. Al-Mujahireen are the most extreme form because they are very public. They, in a way, I think this is why they have not been as prosecuted as much as they should have been, because they are so open about their hatred of the West. They are easy to monitor. But an awful lot of the major mosques, where, you know, they're the large mosques, and like the Boston Mosque, you know, they have been run by people who believe in quite extreme forms of Islam. And to try and pretend that Islam is nonviolent is really not helping. For most people, they interpret it in a nonviolent way, but there are enough people who aren't distorting the text. They are just choosing to make certain texts very important. They have ideologues, people like Anwar al-Awlaki, before he was bombed by a drone strike. People like Omar Bakri Muhammad, who has not been bombed by a drone strike yet. In fact, Omar Bakri Muhammad was actually given a life sentence for being involved in Tripoli in... it's not the Tripoli in Libya. There is Tripoli in Lebanon, in the north of the country. There was a Palestinian refugee camp there, and he had been involved with slaughtering people there, a plot. He had been found guilty, and then for some reason, the two people who had given testimony to get him convicted, several people had died as a result of, you know, the actions he was allegedly involved with, but the two major witnesses later recanted their testimony, either through bribery or threat. And so he is again awaiting retrial. He's a very lucky man in many ways, but he seriously does get involved in insurrections and violence and supports beheading of people. We've, at the beginning of the show, I don't want to rewind and recap what I've already said, but the Al-Mujahireen ethos is part of a new strand, in the global terms, of Islam, which began in 1979 when the Mujahideen started to evolve. At the end, in November 1979, they fled from Saudi Arabia to Afghanistan, and it was there that the Mujahideen began to evolve. That was where Al-Qaeda came from. That's where Abdullah Azam became the main theologian. And we cannot ignore those aspects. That is the problem. The Salafists, as I call them, the people who wear beards and silly hats, the ones who just refuse to integrate, they are always going to be the problem. After, when we had in Britain, in 7-7, on the 7th of July 2005, when we had 52 people were blown up, with two people who had been involved with Al-Mujahireen, This man, Muhammad Siddiqui Khan and Shehzad Tanweer, had both been meeting with al-Mujahirun members, who themselves were convicted of plotting bombings. Now, when that happened, this notion of the bombings being a great shock to the British community, we had a man called Zaki Badawi. Now, he was actually very much involved with interfaith work, which wasn't a lot of interfaith work involves Muslims preaching in churches, but then these same Muslims won't allow Christians to preach in their mosques because it's, you know, they're not allowed to. But he was advising young Muslim women and Muslim men to not dress wearing burqas, to try to show that they were just like other people. It didn't work that way. People started wearing more and more of these silly burqas, identifying themselves as, we're not part of your society. And it has he died in February 2006, and we haven't had many people to replace him in Britain. We get an awful lot of people from the Muslim Brotherhood pretending to be moderate because the males dress in suits and ties. They're not moderate at all. They believe, as Hassan al-Banna said, the founder of the Muslim Brotherhood, jihad is our way. And this doesn't mean, like with Ahmed Rehab in America putting posters on buses saying, yo, my jihad is to be nicer to my neighbor. Bollocks. Jihad, for a lot of people, means violence. And it has done for a long time. And if we don't start addressing that there are aspects of Islam, if people want to follow those, they must go to a country where they're allowed to. Because if you're living in the West, where it isn't right to kill people for insulting your prophet, then you have no right to act in that way. The laws of the land must come first. But in a country like Britain, we've got more than 100 Sharia courts around the place where people are being encouraged. They're being encouraged not to integrate. People must integrate if they want Islam to be really positive in the country. They must integrate. Dressing up in silly clown costumes, men in 90s, men in skirts with beards, do not do anything to integrate with the society at large. People who refuse to let their kids marry anyone from this country because they must have somebody from the home country are not integrating. These are the lessons that people need to learn to get to solve the problem. Oh, we've got a visitor's come back. What happened to you? You've not been around. And somebody's swearing in the chat room. That is absolute. I will not tolerate swearing in the chat room. I don't believe in swearing at all. Anyway, but this is what is needed. People must integrate. If people like Anjem Chowdhury and their mob insist on being separate, society and other Muslims must start condemning them. And when the mosques are run by Deobandis, who are the same ideology as the Taliban, and the biggest mosques are funded by Saudi Arabia, which still executes people for sorcery and witchcraft, there is no integration there. This is what is the problem. What happened on Wednesday? There was integration on the streets. People, after the Olympics, showed that in London you can have a multicultural, a multiracial, multi-ethnic society easily. A multicultural society where you have different cultures which don't integrate cannot work. You have islands and pockets which do not fit in with the rest. And this is what Anjem Chowdhury and al-Mujahirun have been doing for years. Since they began in... right, we have got a phone caller. I'm going to take the call. Hang on 1 minute. Hello, caller. You are on there. Who is this? Is this Jeff?
Good evening, Adrian.
I must be bloody psychic.
I was just thinking, that's why I laughed. I'm sorry, actually my computer went down a little while ago.
Right, I wonder what was happening. You were in the chat room, then you disappeared. Hang on, because we've only got a few minutes left. But yes, how are you, and what do you want to say? Now, to people who are listening,
I was going to say of the events of what happened this week, and how it's I think it's shaken us all up, isn't it? It's just goes to show you that things that we've been talking about, you actually saw it in one of our London streets. You see that,
yes.
One of our,
and the world has seen it now. And exactly. Britain cannot be allowed to say it is only just occasional. Those images of that man, Michael Adebawola, now with his hands covered in blood, have gone around the world. Now, you cannot address that problem by platitudes and nonsense about, fluffy bunnies and tree hugging.
No.
You have to take directly
to
say...
the right way, isn't it? Yeah.
Well, it's something, and I don't believe we should fight back. I mean, I don't believe in, I know that you're affiliated with the EDL, and I don't approve of the tactics of demonstration, because I don't think they really work. I know that they feel good when people are angry. But I'm not going to criticise, that's not my, I'm not out to do that on my last show of, attacking people. Because I think people are very, very upset. What I'm concerned with this show is...
the word, Adrian.
Yes.
I was surprised.
I still do. Shit. Look, you hang on the line. We'll carry on talking, all right?
Okay, Adrian.
For the people on the recording. But I have to say to people in the chat room, we've only got officially 90... It's less than 90 seconds left. This... I may have another show. I don't know. Officially, I'm retired. I've got rid of all of my smutty music, and I've just got the Bumblebee song left for Reese Cup. But I want to thank everybody for listening, and I will reappear in some form. I'm trying to work with some Australian people about getting a website together where I'm going to put my previous archived articles up. So I will be reappearing in some form. I want to thank everybody who has been listening. This has been a very, very traumatic week, and I don't want to diminish anything. But what people have been feeling in the community is great shock. Hopefully, out of shock, something might be done. I sadly feel that we will just go back to doing what we used to do, of just trying to pretend it hasn't happened, because that is what will eventually happen. We won't have learned as a society the lessons unless people on the ground wake up and start saying, okay, integrate or you're never going to help the society. Now, thank you for listening, everybody in the chat room. Jeff, stay online. Thank you, everybody, and good night. If you listen to the recording, you can hear the rest of what we're talking about. We are now into overtime, Jeff. So now we can relax a little bit and
chill out.
Well, yes. I mean, the tone, you bring the tone down, actually.
Do I? No, be quite honest with you, when I had the show last night, I was pretty raw. What I've done is I straight away opened up the line so anybody wanted to call in. Yeah. And the thing what happened last night, because there was a family emergency from Tommy, who was the co-host, I was going solo last night, so I was having to keep an eye on the chat and everything. But it's thank goodness I got...
Was that the Tommy who called in when you first called in on the show?
Yes.
Is he family okay?
Yeah, it was his little brother. He was he started screaming, and he didn't know what was the matter. He just started screaming, and of course Tommy he panicked a bit. He called the called the ambulance, and they took his little brother, and what had happened, it's just a bad belly bug or whatever it was. He seems better today, thank goodness. Because you never know when, you know, he's under a year. I think he's about 8 months, 9 months old. He's still a pretty, you know, like a baby, like. But
right.
It seems like he's okay. It's just that he's had a pretty bad, he had a bit of bad. But so I called Tommy, because what I do, basically, I turn my, because I've got my mobile phone and it's going ding, ding, ding all the time with emails coming through all the time. So I switch it off just because, you know, I mean, you get an email, especially from, you know, the East Anglians, you know, any sort of news coming through. As I've said before, we could run the show 24 hours a day with the different news that's coming in from all over the world.
Well, I mean, I didn't deal with the plane issues, you know, the fact that...
oh, my goodness me. Yeah, there's more behind that.
You know, the two people
flying.
Who tried to get onto that plane. So I was thinking this evening, you know, before the show, if those people who had tried to get into the cockpit of the Pakistan plane, if they were serious and they did that in the very last part of it, if they had actually managed to get in, what could have happened? If they had crashed that plane into London...
I think they'd have headed for a big target in London as well, because honestly, something like they're there towards Big Ben or something.
I don't think it would even matter if they chose any target, because London is so highly populated, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
That any point of it, you would kill thousands.
Exactly. This is what I'm saying. As you know, like myself, Adrian, we know what London's like. Any part of London. If they wish to destroy
it's only
anywhere,
the suburbs where you get a bit more space, you know.
Exactly, but as I say, when they say it was a police, it's a police bear, I would say that they've done that for a reason. I do believe there's a lot more. I'm not one, but I do believe there's a lot more than what they're trying. They don't want to panic the public, so they're going to keep a little bit.
I know.
Keep
it could end up with really big reactions, because there is an element of provocation. Now, we've often, because you're affiliated with the EDL, and I've always tried to not be affiliated with the EDL, even though we both share the same worries about what the hell is coming to our country. We have different opinions about how that is going to be solved. But I've never seen you as a bad person or anything like that.
Well, thanks a lot, Adrian. No, I'm not a bad, but the thing is that I suppose I look at myself as I love my country, and what I see is going on in it is it's soul destroying, and I think if whatever
I love
I
the
can
diversity
do,
of Britain as well. This is what pisses me off.
Yeah.
Is that I love the diversity of it, and because ever since 1989, because before 1989 I would see Asian people, and I would think, well, some might be Muslim, some might be Hindu, some might be Sikh. And then all of a sudden, Muslims, after the Salman Rushdie thing, became a political entity in Britain.
And
everything started to change from then on in the way that they became a political. Before that, they had been tied up with the, either the Asian on general, there used to be BBC programmes on a Sunday morning. You remember those? The Asian language programme.
I remember.
You'd have a Sikh with a nice little tank top that was sort of, you know, a nicely knitted tank top with this sort of, you know, little Sikh sort of turban on. Then you'd have a Muslim with a little white cap, and then you'd have a Hindu, and they'd all be talking in Urdu or Punjabi or something that was difficult to understand.
I remember that.
Yeah, but they, yes,
but
they,
you know,
they used to be, they differentiate between faith. They were collectively viewed as from India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, Asian. And then suddenly with the Salman Rushdie thing, all of a sudden Muslims just suddenly jumped out of the closet and were suddenly a fully formed political entity. And that changed everything. People, you know, before that, people saw there were mosques and they were, you know, going up in places, but they weren't mass mosque buildings like there are, you know, over the last 10, 20 years. 1989 was a watershed where suddenly the Muslim political activists had stepped out. They'd hidden behind race relations. You know, oh, we're black people. you know, they were saying before when they were Asians.
Yes.
And then, you know, they went from being, well, we're not black, we're Asians, we are our own pressure group. And then from that to being, we're Muslims, so we have nothing to do with the Sikhs or the... It's just sort of various levels of...
I know, it was... As if you look it over like that, it was quite... You was probably like me, Adrian, living it, the people, you know, that's their faith, that's whatever.
Yeah.
And I've always been that same, as live and let live. But all of a sudden, it started to impose itself. It started to, well, you know, as it's unfolded and the things happened, that all of a sudden, these, you know, I'd all say the political correctness cancer became a pretty strong hold on politicians, and it's weakened, it's emboldened these extremists amongst them, and this is what they've gradually become more and more emboldened till now. They're openly declaring war on us, you know. It's the,
but it's been the declaration of war, which is what I was trying to show with the show, and unfortunately you went offline for quite a period because of, you know, it's not your fault, but what I'm trying to say is it's actually gone back in terms of from 1998, that was when Omar Bakri Mohammed issued a death fatwa. Now, I didn't have the full text in front of me. I only quoted from him talking about the fatwa. But the fatwa said that it was the duty of any Muslim anywhere to kill either, specifically, he was talking about killing John Major. The duty of any Muslim to kill him. And then you had one of the people who had signed this document was the head of the Muslim Lawyers Association.
Exactly.
A fatwa calling for the death of the Prime Minister of the country, that any Muslim, it's their duty to do this. And he wasn't prosecuted either. So they took it to the next level.
Incitement to kill. Sort of say something like that, or you, Adrian, or any of us, was to say something like that, then we'd feel the full wrath of the British justice come really firmly down. But it seems like they are, I've said it before, it feels like they're a protected species. If we do that, they might riot. Oh dear, what are we going to do? People could lose their... This is it. It's the fear of what they can do, because they've shown themselves quite openly that anybody's got a fart in the wrong way against Islam, and they want to go out there burning, killing. I'll tell you something that's really, it's made me very angry to see what a beautiful country Sweden was, and it's a country that I really wanted to spend a bit of time. Swedish people, lovely people. And what I've been seeing over the last 5 days of these people.
The riots to Stockholm, yes.
It's just unbelievable. You know what really annoys me and pisses me off, Adrian? It's even the beautiful Swedish women have changed the colour of their hair from being blonde, have changed it to dark, to maybe add a little bit of protection. To me, that says something. That says that something needs to be done with this horrible cult of theirs. It needs to be outlawed. I really do mean it. It needs to be outlawed, because this is just... We are in a global jihad, as you know. This is a global jihad. They have declared war on us all. We've got to respond in kind. We just can't.
Well, the thing is, it's a question. I don't even know if we need. I mean, this is the thing. Let me just explain what I think. Because on this issue of what happens with Muslim activists is that when they are met with force, they become compliant. And I don't mean force in terms of physical violence, which as government force. You know, when governments insist that they toe the line, then they do because they have to.
Yeah.
But when they're allowed to do whatever they want, then they get worse.
Yeah, exactly.
The younger generation.
Given
the
inch, they take a yard, is the old saying, isn't it, Adrian? Given an inch, they take a yard, and that's what we see them all the time. They're allowed to go, you know, do things. They just deteriorates the situations, and quite openly, I'll tell you what, Adrian. This attack, to me, what happened this with that young
chap. On Wednesday,
chap.
Yes, in Woolwich. Having been
brutal a lot. To me, I think this was planned to be at Woolwich because, as we know, on the 6th of June...
They were following him. They knew exactly. They wouldn't have known. Just because he had a Help for Heroes T-shirt on wasn't enough. They had to have targeted him. They were following him for days. I'm convinced of it. They were telling people that he was a soldier. They didn't have his ID. They knew who he was. They had targeted him. Just like Parviz Khan in Birmingham, he had a short list of 25 Muslim soldiers. He had specifically pinpointed the one target that he was going to home in on. He had intended to have this guy locked up in a lock-up garage, tortured on video camera, and ultimately beheaded. He was a guy who worked in military intelligence. They had his name. He had focused on this one person. He had worked out how he was going to get him kidnapped. He was going to use drug dealing gangs to do it. Because there's a crossover. I mean, if you heard the way that Michael Adebowale, what was his name? God, I can't remember his bloody name. Because there's two of them. Well, there's Adebowale. He was the guy who wasn't speaking to the camera. And this sort of whole thing of the younger guy, Michael Adebolajo, he was actually the older one, 28 years old. I mean, he was sort of, I don't know, he was trying to provoke, he was trying to get, the way he was talking, it was very acclimated. It was like a gangland speak, it was London slang. They have a lot of crossover. These people from Al-Mujahroon, I think I didn't get to say on the main show, they have a lot of links with prison. They have a lot of links with the drug crowds. This is how they recruit. Because a lot of the... And this is, again, the culture of arranged marriages. Now, when you have arranged marriages, people like Muhammad Sadiq Khan, he didn't marry the right... He married a woman of his choice. His father rejected him. And so he became sucked into radicalism because, like with gang culture in America, it becomes a family. You get love from your brothers because your family didn't give it to you. And this gangland aspect is very, Al-Mujahroon, they're very streetwise in that aspect. They're very close to the gangland, prison, I don't know. And his whole demeanor of when he was talking, it was just like listening to somebody who was trying to speak like a Jamaican yardie, even though he was from African origin. And it had that sort of street aspect to it. And they used to recruit.
What did you think of those ladies that confronted them?
I thought they were brilliant. I thought they were
so brave.
They were more than brave. They were human. Yeah. They were concerned for, there's photographs of one actually touching Lee Rigby, like trying to, even though he was dead as a, totally dead, but, touching him, like to reassure him, to console him, even though he was dead. There was a compassion that was in it. Compassion and bravery together. I thought it was wonderful mix.
They didn't
fear
their own lot. That's what I was going to say, Adrian. It's that these people are just absolutely, barbaric act they've just committed. And these two women, and I think actually one of them comes from my neck of the woods there, where I am now. I'm sure someone did say that she comes from Ipswich or whatever, but that's another story. But it was just that they were so brave. They were so brave. And I do, this is just one of the stories that's come out, is that there was police behind the cars. There was way back up. There's these two women facing these two
with blood on their hands, carrying axes and machetes. It was really quite very powerful, and I think, you know, infuriated me to read Caroline Glick and this Fernandez character in pyjamas. Media talking about the British being spineless. Well, maybe the police might have been a little bit spineless, or maybe they were just waiting.
You know, let's be honest, Adrian, there's two ladies there. They could have been butchered, they could be slaughtered. All they were thinking about was trying to get to that man. They thought they might be able to do something. They just wanted, and they said, look, just back up. I see one of them sitting, and I thought, oh, she might have been pushed out. It looked like she'd been put in one clip, I see, that looked like she'd been pushed out. But she just wanted to look after that guy, because she wasn't sure.
Lee Rigby.
We know exactly what they'd done to him, but we won't go into too many graphic details because it's already been talked about, being on the street and stuff now. But it's just, what can you say about people? It just, this is what courage is, you know, it's people, just talking to people.
The courage of moral decency. And that is something which is lacking both in the leadership, both in our media writers, our television news, you know, the BBC are even trying to question, is this a terrorist attack or not? Bloody hell.
Well, they would, to be honest, Adrian, we're coming to a time. I do believe, Adrian, just let me share my thought with you, that,
that
they will be held accountable for what's going on in this country. Whatever's going to happen in this country, they will be. They've got blood on their hands already. These politicians and the people trying to, they've got blood on their hands, you know, with things that's gone on before. Not just, this young stuff, but they've got blood on their hands already. And, you know, a lot of things that we're seeing there, and things that stuff, you know, I'm expecting that this is opening the door, because this is giving them a green light, that this is what I've got a feeling that maybe this was something to do with this flight that was coming in, that, you know, this was a green light, okay, let's do this, you know, let's put them under, let's give them, show them what Islam's all about, basically, or whatever they... when a client, they're showing what jihad's all about. And I do believe that we haven't seen the end of these attacks. I do believe.
I think it's the beginning of a whole new thing. And I think Mohammed Merah began that. You know, I mean, it's all very well to try and break up into just being al-Mujaharun. But as I was trying to say during the show, that they have their other influences going back. It's like the new Islam. You know, people try and say, oh, Islam isn't about that. Some old grey-bearded old man who's, you know, been studying his books for years. But the thing is, there is a new jihad. There is a new Islam that's been forged in places like Afghanistan, which is all about, motivated by this idea of there is not a caliphate anymore. They have this profound sense of loss of identity, of cultural identity. And all of this talk about Muslim lands and, you know, Muslim people and we're all one ummah, it's like, it's desperation. It is, in a way, it's people who have mentally put themselves up against some sort of wall, whereas they don't have to be there. If they wanted to be a member of the human race, which I think is much more important, then they wouldn't have to be putting themselves into that position. But it is a new form of... It's partly a sense... They have a sense of victimhood, and they have a sense of supremacism at the same time. It's a weird combination. They, at one level, we're aggrieved. It's our brothers are suffering. You know, when he was saying about the... I'm sorry about the women had to see this, but our women in Arab lands have to see this. You know? We're victimized, we're being oppressed, but we ultimately will take control of you and you will be our slaves. I mean, that is the subtext.
That's what I read of it. It's basic basically you're making a threat to the women. Your women, you know, we're coming after the women. That sort of thing. It's what we've all said. The booty, you know, it's very. How many times have we heard the word booty used? And the booty, isn't it? It's a form of. This is where you're going to rape your women. That's the beauty. What my right hand will possess, sort of thing, isn't it?
Yes.
Agent, I've got to say, I was really, it was very strange because I just had a feeling that you would do this show tonight. I just knew you were a fired up sort of guy. You see, you thought, I've got to do this. You know, I've got to do this. And it was really hard because I was so raw last night, and I had to make. I made a statement. Didn't have to. It's a statement from the English Defence League, and I could give it my best shot, and I just said, look, anybody wants to call in, you're feeling more, call in and vent.
Right.
Just call in and vent and say what you've got to say, and think, what I'm talking about tonight, please, you know, this is your place, you know, you can come here and you can speak out and how you're feeling.
Right.
And this is the place to share your thoughts and where we go with what we do. And so that's what I wanted to do. And I don't think it went too bad last night.
Unfortunately, I understand why Tommy Robinson was upset and went out to Woolwich on that night. But I think that the media then treated it badly. He did I saw a bit of it today, a video. He was being interviewed by somebody. It's gone by Coilus Media or something. It's on YouTube. And he actually came across very articulately. And I just wish that he had tried that on the night rather than gathering.
Well,
but then again,
was,
when Diana died, do you remember when Diana died? I don't know if you, and I was in London, and it was weird.
Oh,
all these people just migrated to the centre of town. It was like there was some weird thing pulling people.
It was a heartbreak. It was the nation was heartbroken. We just got put it that way. We was heartbroken. I know I was. She was a beautiful woman.
That was what happened yesterday. But I just, the day before yesterday. And I just think that, you know, his video that he did or the interview with him, I think he actually portrayed himself very, very well.
I think so.
Verbally.
There's a lot of raw emotion there as well. And he was, as I said about...
I didn't agree with all of what he said. I think he did generalise sometimes, but I think that, you know, the main points... Unfortunately, just that one incident, the amount of people on the sort of the left, the so-called... Because I see myself at the moment moving further and further to the left in many ways, you know, not the far left, you know what I mean, but away from the sort of the right wing to the sort of left wing. I mean, I like to see myself in the middle and not being part of any party, but in terms of, I can't relate to Tories and their sort of arrogance, you know, their sense of entitlement. But I've just sort of was really shocked by the way some of the people on the left took what had happened with the meeting of the EDL as if they are behind of a backlash and that they are to blame. And, the thing is, the only people who were to blame, really, in all of this, were the people who had done the killing and the people who had inspired them. And the fact that they had been allowed to...
Yeah.
Preach for death and jihad for so long with impunity.
I mean, this is what I say. We live in very strange times, don't we, with what we see around us. You know, I like to think that what we've been doing, if we hadn't been around, say the English Defence League had never formed, I mean, you know, say today, I don't know. You know, for the last 4 years, what would have happened? How things would have deteriorated? Maybe as you said to me once before on one of the other shows, if say the police had done their job at the time, would the English Defence League have formed? Well, I think the way that the English Defence would not have formed maybe a bit later on,
right.
If some other event. But if it was that the police done their jobs instead of doing this political correct sort of policing,
yeah.
or shall we say, yeah, political policing as such. Maybe we people like ourselves wouldn't have been called to the forefront of what was going on, because we feel, I mean, like most of us feel, that we've got no a government that hasn't got no backbone, that doesn't want to. They come out, David Cameron come out, oh, I'm going to put my serious face on. I've got to look very angry. How do I look, dude? Is this my serious face? And he comes out and he makes... It's true, isn't it? Oh, you can imagine it. How serious do I look? I haven't got that smiley look on my face like I normally have. No, dear. Oh, let me kick you in the leg. There you go. Oh, that hurts. Now, that's it. Go for it, David. Now. Go now.
Oh, God.
You know, it's true.
I had a little picture of him, unfortunately, when you sort of said that. Yeah, it is very contrived, and it's a very shallow dealing with it. The things he's saying, you know,
we've been all seen through it, aren't we? It's a charade.
Yeah.
It's not very good at it either.
Do you think, what do you think? Because, I mean, if they hadn't had the poachers, you know, the Anglian regiment in... Luton, if they hadn't been insulted by that little group led by Saiful Islam's branch of the Luton Al-Mujaharoon, or, you know, Islam for UK, whatever they were calling themselves at that time, because they're always changing their names, but it's basically Al-Mujaharoon.
They kept being outlawed, didn't they?
Yes.
Or those
15 people, you know, spitting at the soldiers. Now, if that hadn't happened, I mean, what do you think would have happened? Would it have spontaneously something else?
I'll be quite honest with you, Adrian, over the years, I mean, before that actually led up to, as you say, when the poachers was returning from overseas and doing their duty, I would say, because for many years, you know, I've been speaking out against this, this cult, because I hate to call it a religion, because I can't see anything.
Okay,
it's an ideology masquerading as religion. It's the only thing I can really say. But, you know, I used to have what we used to call the Crusader Castle. I had a good friend. I had a good friend in Canada, actually. I haven't spoke to him for a little while, but we created the Crusader Castle in Paltor. And we used to talk about this. We used to talk about there'll be a day something's going to happen that's going to define a group that would come forward. Now, I didn't know how it would come about, but I knew something like the English kid. And it totally blew me away when I see, you know, the mission statement of what the English Defence League is about. Because anybody who wants to really get a true feel of, you know, everything that was in that mission statement, I stand by. We stand with Israel. We stand, you know, with human rights. We are a human rights organisation. We're registered as a human rights organisation, even though we call ourselves the English Defence League. We're diverse, because everybody can be involved with what we do, even Muslims. We've got Muslims in the Defence League. You know, we've got Abdullah. We've got quite a few lads who's Muslim. But, of course, you know, we've got the leftists and the government portraying us. And this is what pisses me off more than anything. We're not a far-right organisation whatsoever. We're not affiliated to no political party, and we never have been. Well, yeah, okay, Tommy and Kevin, they was affiliated to the British Freedom Party, but, as we know, Tommy stepped away when he was in prison. He was under the lead.
Where does Kevin Carroll now fit within that? Is he within the EDL, or is he with the Freedom Party, or what? Because Paul Weston has left the Freedom Party.
He's with the Liberty. I was going to say, Adrian,
another group. Yeah. I'm totally confused. I don't. I mean, you know a lot more about that than I do, because
I was going to say, I was speaking to Paul. We had Paul Weston as a guest on the show this evening, and my goodness me, he had a good rant tonight on there.
Right.
If you get a chance, please listen to Paul. He was absolutely so. And I've been wanting to talk to, because I haven't talked to Paul before tonight,
right.
and it was absolutely brilliant. So it was a great. It was a great.
Right.
It wasn't so much an interview. It was venting. We were all venting, you know, cell phone.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's important to be able to vent, but I also think it's important to be able to articulate what the problems are and what the solutions are. Now,
I think Paul comes across quite well. He's a great thinker.
Yeah, but the thing is, there are people who I've become acquainted with on the left who I'm starting to see as being, some of them are really very decent, you know. Others are so sort of ideologically primed to throw and project onto people what they want to see, not what they do see. And I've had a lot of that thrown at me recently, trying to engage in conversations.
I know, you told me about that. I think you said that.
Yeah, I mean, I was just pissed off then. I mean, I'm pretty used to it. I'm used to having people, you know, to me, to others, I am a blank canvas that people paint their own pictures on and then paint me in whatever colours that they want to see me.
Well, Adrian, you've got large shoulders. It's always nice to have large shoulders. You know what I'm
Actually, I had to go and buy an extra large shirt today, not because of my stomach, because my shoulders wouldn't fit into a normal one. But sorry.
I told you got large. You need to have large shoulders. Before things be talking, and you do. Sometimes I look at some comments that, and I'm not going to say anything, but some people make comments, and I think. Do you know what? I don't even want to go there. I don't even talk about it. I'm treating with contempt. How do you get that way? I mean, you can't be...
Well, I kicked one person off when he was, you know, making jokes about the guy who was killed.
Well, you know, Agent, you know, that I'd have done exactly the same. It did.
You know, I won't
what
tolerate...
What can we say? That's despicable, isn't it?
Yeah, there are things I won't sink to, and one of my Facebook friends was promoting... showing a photograph, you know, of the guy, you know, with the red hands and with Lee Rigby in the road behind him, and was using that as an excuse to argue about Obama and gun control. If this man, this soldier, if he'd had a gun, this perhaps wouldn't happen. And I was thinking, you're trying to use a tragedy where this man has not even been buried yet. His family, really, having watched them, it was awful.
Did you see?
Pain
the,
on the TV.
I'm watching it now, Adrian. It's on TV now. It's heartbreaking.
And to then have some little shit trying to use it as part of his Obama bashing.
Yeah.
And I just thought, you
But we always get these people out there, don't we, Adrian?
Well, he was one of my fucking friends on Facebook who, you know, I mean, he's annoyed me. I've got a Belgian gay friend who's had, like, all sorts of problems, and he was being really sneering to him and saying, but I've got nothing against gay people. And this guy, you know, in Belgium, he's had all sorts of stuff. Even his pets have been attacked by his Muslim neighbour and stuff. You know what I mean? Yes. And
I've got no time for these bigots.
This American guy is when you take a tragedy, because this is not, it's a political act, it's a tragedy, it's all sorts of things, it's a national state event, because it's to do with our soldiers, you know, and how we feel about ourselves as a nation. You know, because I think the Olympics showed that there could be pride in being British, no matter what colour or creed you were.
Yeah, exactly.
And I think there was a bit of that spirit came back and was shown in Woolwich, you know?
Yes.
And
I agree.
Really, when you get some knobhead in America who's just only can think of Obama and then decides to exploit this pitch, and I tried to remonstrate. I said, look, I think this is really sick. You're exploiting it. The guy hasn't even been buried yet. You know, the emotions are so raw. And He said, it's my freedom of speech to talk about gun control.
And
I said, you know, you're trying to use it to exploit for your American political things. And he said, you know, it's my freedom of speech, and you know, you've got your freedom of speech to disagree. I said, yes, I have. And you fucking Americans think that you're so much better than us, you can fuck off, and I'm going to defriend you. And I did.
We've all been feeling pretty raw. We don't need...
Well, I'm just not going to tolerate this sort of bullshit. Caroline Glick,
no.
You know, from the Jerusalem Post, talking about the spinelessness of the British people. How fucking dare she? You know, this character, Richard Fernandez...
Well, I treat people like that content, Adrian. You know,
yeah, but these are people who are influencing others. And this is what annoys you. They have positions in the media and they're acting irresponsibly. It may be the Jerusalem Post is quite a respected newspaper, and for her to be on her Facebook list pointing to this article by this guy on PJ Media who's saying that, you know, it's called the manhood of the West, that we're all sort of like, you know, limp-wristed sort of wusses. I think, fuck you. You know what I mean? You're there in your ivory tower. You have no right to judge. You have not been there. And you're not seeing what the strength of what is actually... Because in a way, I think this is something that Al-Mujahedin Haroon have not accounted for. Or, you know, the guys doing that, you know, killing thing. Is that, I mean, the whole fact that Help for Heroes got so many people trying to donate money and trying to buy T-shirts, that... Their website,
It was just a mate, because
and I think there are
imagination
coming
people.
Out of this in terms of it is showing us that there is a Britain which can be multiracial, which can deal with an atrocity and deal with it productively. Those two women, you know, as we were saying, that compassion is that courage in compassion. You know, I think there was a lot of good that should come out of this, but it's still so painful. You know, when you see those family, you know, his, I mean, she's really his ex.
I know, I'm watching it now, Adrian. It's on, I've got it on my TV.
Well,
and look at this family being totally destroyed.
And I think people are going to say raw and angry things sometimes. You know, I think I've used the word cunt several times tonight, and I just, I've just used it again, you know. But I really just don't give a fuck anymore. I'm just so...
I know. I can understand it, because you're the same as me, Adrian. You know, when it comes down to it, you know, we all stand together against these, you know, the way that they've been trying to impose this. And this is us. This is what we do. Expect more of this. This is basically what that guy's saying. You know, what you think? We're sorry, but you know, this is going to happen. Blah blah. And you think, well, this is what you're going to expect if we don't clamp down.
I think
we don't
people
do
like Anne Jim Chowdhury should be from now on not. I mean, there should be. I wish there was some campaign in his local shops not to serve or sell his family anything. You know what I mean? That sort of. So that he'd have to move
I can't believe that with all that's gone on, that Anjan Chowdhury has never, ever been arrested. Even with all these, there's been quite a few converts who've gone, you know, who've become radicalised after a number of years, a couple of years or so, that they've, with Richard Dark, what they was planning to do. Perhaps serving 6 years now for what he was. Was it 6 years he served? I think it's 6 years.
I don't know the
six
exact.
Or 7 years.
Yeah.
And that's set through Anjan Chowdhury. With his, he converted them and they become radicalised. So,
because he was
made,
trained as a lawyer, he's very canny at being able to just say enough that he can imply. To go out and do these things, you know what I mean? When I read out, I don't know if you heard me reading out
bounds of the law.
Well, I was.
But no, I'm surprised, really, though, that because there's been quite a few things that he said. I thought if I was to make a statement like he's made, or if you was to make anything like that, I'm sure the police would be wanting to have
Well, I was trying to suggest on the show. I mean, I know you missed quite a bit of it. I was trying to suggest on the show that. People have suggested it elsewhere as well, that, you know, they're being monitored by the MI5, by MI5 and everything, but monitoring is not enough. One of his friends was saying that an MI5 guy had tried to recruit him to become an informant or a spy or whatever, but it's like, I don't think it should work that way. These are the radicals. You know who they are. You must silence their ability to, if they're going to hold a demonstration, and, you know, they should be not allowed to. There was footage when you had in February the 3rd, 2006, when they were first showing off with their placards saying, "Behead those who insult Islam." There was a footage on BBC
Two. Does it still go that now, Adrian?
Sorry?
Does it still go that 2006?
Yes.
My goodness me.
Now, that was when they were first showing...
It was just like yesterday. Yeah,
yeah, well, exactly. I was... I mean, the thing is, my point is, there was a taxi driver who had stopped his taxi, and he was seeing these people with these placards saying, "Europe, you will pay, 9/11 is on its way, behead those who insult Islam," etc.
Yeah,
and
I remember
this,
now.
The taxi driver was complaining to this young policeman saying, "Look what they're doing, look what they're doing. They shouldn't be allowed to do that. What are you going to do about it?" And this policeman, cool as a cucumber, says to him, "Oh, they're having a demonstration. It's their right to express their opinions." And then he said to the taxi driver, "If you don't get in your car now, I'm going to arrest you." When the taxi driver was just asking the police,
"Breach of peace," or something like that.
Yes,
it's just
almost like saying that he would
show up in arms. But
You remember we're cutting in on each other. In
sorry, sorry about that.
But, you know, you've got to take into consideration that that meeting that the policeman was saying it was their right, it was an illegal demonstration. By being an illegal demonstration, they should have rounded everybody up.
Yeah.
And, you know, this is, if they don't use those tactics, that group will just carry on. And if they do go underground, it doesn't matter, because if you go underground, they've already known who these people are. It's the fact that they can be seen to get away with all of this stuff. That was the provocation, the thing with the poppies. Only a £50 fine for the man from Muslims Against Crusades who burnt poppies. People who were protesting against
that. Did he pay for that, though, did he, Adrian? I think Andrew
Sherwood. No, I don't think so.
That.
No. And they didn't chase it up.
Yeah. But
I mean,
I suppose look at that when Tommy
the
got
inequality.
Yeah.
Sorry, yeah.
No, I was going to say. I mean, you say that, but when Tommy Robinson went to court over it, he got fined £750 for pulling that flag out of that Muslim's hands, the black flag. And they tried to put it down, and he assaulted a policeman. And the trouble was, there was so much footage of exactly what happened, with the police dragging Tommy down and actually laying into him, actually, sort of smacking him about a bit, that they couldn't make that stick. So I think actually the charge was dropped. But then they reintroduced it. He actually got fined for it in the end. They dropped it, and then it's like, how can they do that? They drop a child, then they come back and they revisit, and then he's now. I've never been able to get my head around that, actually. But he got fined, was it 700? I think it's £750, about seven times more than what the original, the poppy burners were getting.
He got, the one guy who was prosecuted from Muslims Against Crusade got £50 fine.
That's right.
I mean,
yeah.
That is just, it's not right at all. But, I mean, this is the thing, this isn't the first time. This is why I think it's so important that what happened on Wednesday, it must be the last time that the police don't apply the law equally to everybody. They have gone for too long treating one group of people, the radical Islamists, as if they were like royalty. They can do what they want. And that is not the way to actually make it doesn't make for community cohesion. It divides people. It makes people feel jealous.
Yes.
The white working class people in Britain, now I'm a bit middle class, but my parents both came from working class backgrounds. But the white working class people of Britain have been shafted since the 80s. Thatcher started it all. And then in 1989, when all of a sudden the Muslims start demanding rights, it's like they're regarded as privileged because they are white. So it's been perfectly acceptable to deny them jobs, housing, political representation. Labour politicians who should be supporting the white working classes have done nothing. So then groups like the BNP have tried to move in, and only then, that man was Emdadur Chowdhury, aged 26 at the time, who was fined 50 quid for his Armistice Day thing. I mean, really, really sick.
I know.
But, this whole thing, if you cannot treat society, everybody is in this society. If you want to have one society, you must treat it as one society, not as a patchwork of little fiefdoms and kingdoms. And you've got this little jihadist kingdom in one area that wants to be in control, and then a gangland area where you've got yardy sort of armed, gunfighters going on in Shoreditch, for example. It doesn't work that way. There is a perfectly good way of having a multiracial, multi-ethnic, unified society, and we're almost there in so many ways, but we've got all of these ridiculous politicians and policemen who think that they want to tread so gently, they don't want to upset things and create a problem. If you put people at each other's throats, if you said, we've only got a little bit of cake, so we're going to hold up the crumbs and we're going to give the crumbs to one group and ignore the other, or we're going to give legal rights to one group and to deny another group its legal rights, which is what's happened with the Islamists and the white working classes, you are creating a recipe for disaster. You invite people in from any part of the world and say, oh, whatever you believe in, we'll embrace it. But anybody from Britain who says they're proud to be British is demonized as a racist, even if they're not racist, but they're just saying, I want my country to be what it was when I was growing up.
How about this word? It's a couple of words which I picked up from Paul Weston, which I've been sitting up early on tonight just looking at this, and it really, really comes to the forefront of my mind. Population replacement. And social engineering.
Yes.
I don't know if you agree with me.
Yeah, I used to use social engineering in some of my articles before, and it sort of, in a way, that was what Labour was doing. I don't know what the Tory Liberal, I don't know what this current government is doing on that. They just seem to be just sort of drifting from one collision to another without any sort of sense of purpose.
Maybe there is a plan behind it. Maybe that is there's a strategy behind this.
When Mrs. Thatcher was in power, she calculated that you could have the whole of the North East with rampant unemployment. She worked out the maths that we can do that. We'll make wealth for the people in London and the city. And what doesn't matter if South Wales miners or, the North East all end up with, mass unemployment and no jobs and no industries, because as long as the rest of the country's okay and people are buying their council houses, it can all look good.
Yeah.
And maybe there is some similar agenda going on now.
They think we could
just get rid of the inner cities, let them become like urban warfare, as long as we have our nice little, as long as we've got our gherkin and other things that we can live in above all the mess at the bottom,
I believe if it comes down to where things deteriorate so bad, as we don't like to talk about, but there is some serious issues on the streets, whatever.
I had been hoping to God that sort of somehow or other that could be avoided. In a way, last week when I gave up on the show, I mean, the various reasons, because I've been trying to bridge build, but you can't bridge build in a divided culture when the intellectual elite, the publishers, the media are all brainwashed, and they read the fucking Guardian and all of its stupid bloody sanctimonious piffle that it puts out.
I agree.
Which all pretends to be, you know, let's all, these poor Palestinians, blah, 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 and, you know, or it's like this ideology, when they printed Glenn Greenwald's thing of saying exactly what this killer said on Wednesday, you know, that if he was suggesting that if Britain and America changed their foreign policy, then we wouldn't have any terrorism anymore. What bollocks! There'd be another excuse. There would be a cartoon. There would be something on TV. There would be South Park would lead them on another jihad. These particular people are primed to use any excuse. And they, again, I mean, I was reading some of the other stuff before about Anjem Chowdhury saying Muslims are being picked on, blah, 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 blah. What he does is he picks on the rest of the whole of society, and the whole of society sits back and lets him do it, because I think Britain still is pretty much a laid-back culture. We like people to be able to be free to express themselves, but it's...
But when they're inciting religious hatred and
as long as you have this politically correct sort of, we're all fluffy bunny tree huggers, you know, mentality, then you're accepted into the fold, you can get your work printed and published, etc., and you can be seen on TV, and everything's all fine. As soon as you start saying, look, I'm sorry, there are things wrong here, and you people in your little elite, you know, your media publishing elite, are not seeing it because you are just living off, you know, they're cynically exploiting what's going on around them, and there isn't enough honesty to people to actually say, what is going on? What is the problem? What is the root of it? If you get bilge like, you know, there is no violence in Islam, well, what fucking planet have you been living on for the last few hundred years? You know?
I mean that's what they had David Cameron come across.
That's what I mean.
This is not what Islam's
his
all about.
It's about a betrayal of Islam. This violence is a betrayal. And has he read the fucking Quran? I mean, Blair used to say that he'd read the Quran. It used to be his bedtime reading. He must have skipped over the first 9 surahs and gone to all the nice bits at the end.
I agree. You know what I was expecting when David Cameron was doing, when he was doing that little thing that he was doing outside there? I was waiting for his nose to grow, you know, like Pinocchio. I was waiting for him to save him.
Because you know this thing about abrogation. You know this thing about abrogation in the Quran? You know, that, you know, if something was said by Muhammad later than something else, then, you know, it knocks out what was said before. One of the very last things that Muhammad said is Surah 9:29. If you look it up, this different wording. Yeah. But what it basically says is, and this is one of the very last things he said, was that fight the unbelievers until they are submissive and they pay you a tax as second-class citizens. You know, in some translations it says, as little ones, you know, or until they are humbled, but i.e., you must fight people who are not Muslim until they are subjugated, humbled, treated as second-class citizens, and then pay you protection money. That's a fucking mafia attitude.
I've said that before.
Of the Quran that cannot be abrogated because nothing else, hardly anything else followed after that. If that was one of the latest parts of the revelations of Muhammad, then that is very much to do with the essence of what is in the Quran, if you take what they say about abrogation. And that is something that is really violent. It is supremacy in a very neo-Nazi style fashion. And it only allows for people of the book to pay the jizya tax. People who are not Buddhists or, you know, pagans can be killed. I mean, really, people need to actually wake up and smell the coffee. Most Muslims ignore those bits, fortunately. just like people reading the Old Testament don't look at some of the, you know, reading the Bible, they don't look at some of the Old Testament.
It's so easy for some of these others to be radicalised by it as well. That's the trouble. Yes, some people can, and you should say there's a lot that, you know, sort of don't go along with a lot of that. But there are, I mean, a percentage that do. And when we're talking about if there's 1.6, 1.7 billion Muslims in the world, and you've got, what, maybe 2 or 3%, that's still a lot of people.
Well, I think
that's
it was interesting, the figures, just recently, they were talking about the American Center for Religious Freedom report by the American government came out. They haven't published all of the detailed reports yet, but in their resume about Britain, they were saying that there were 6.8 million Muslims in Britain. Now, only a few years back, in 2005, 2006, when I started blogging in 2005 on Islamism, there were only 3% of the population. So it's doubled in 8 years. More than doubled.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and that is very, very worrying for the future. If that is the numbers, how it's doubling in that.
Well, if the mosques are being funded by the Saudis and run by the Taliban, or the people who share the same ideology as the Taliban, we're screwed. You know,
well,
we need
unless we stand up and do something now. And I think, actually, it comes to times where sometimes you've got to have some draconian measures. I mean, for people to come into power, that's going to actually not put up with this
2 minutes left,
bullshit,
mate,
that we've been. You know, but Adrian, I've just noticed the time. Once again, thank you for much for taking my call. See, I know I was late again, wasn't I? But Adrian, I hope that this is, because I always enjoy talking to you. You're absolutely brilliant to talk to, and it's nice to share our views, even though we're not 100% on each of us.
Yeah, we both see
the light.
Well, I think we're both worried about what's happening. You believe in direct action. I believe in worming around the corners, you know what I mean? And hoping to sort of influence someone through conversation, which isn't going to work, I know, but, you know.
But we love our country, though. At the end of it, we both love our country.
I would see a lot of good things in Britain, and I like a multiracial society. I just want to see a society where everybody is treated equally, and people try to think of themselves as citizens, not as fifth columnists for an alien army.
I agree with you. But once again, Adrian, I'm going to have to say good night to you. I want to let you wrap.
Well, we're going to be cut off any second now, so thanks, Jeff, anyway, and good luck. All the
best.
It's
been great talking to you. God bless you, brother. And I hope to speak to you in the near future. I hope you do one of these impromptu